You may be the heir to $40,000. You may be the heir to $45,000. Yes, you may be the heir to any one of those amounts of money. And today, the latest clues concerning the heirs to $105,700 in unclaimed estates will be unfolded to you on the American Broadcasting Company's Board of Missing Heirs. Are you a missing heir? Listen carefully. You may be one of the missing heirs we are searching for, or you may have information concerning a missing heir. If you have such information, $75 in United States savings bonds will be paid to you, and in some cases, even more valuable rewards will be paid by the administrators of the unclaimed estate. Listen carefully now to the Board of Missing Heirs. And here is the counselor and advisor to the Board of Missing Heirs, Mr. James Marshall.
Thank you, Gene Kirby, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, the Board of Missing Heirs is on the trail of person or persons, whereabouts unknown, who have money, good cold cash, waiting for them. Briefly, we shall tell you the stories of three unclaimed estates. That of John B. Fontaine, whose missing heir will receive $13,000, that of Louisa Hurl, entailing $40,000, and that of Frederick L. Sage, with $45,000 at stake. In addition, and as time permits, we shall outline the story of Mary O'Brien, who is heir to $7,700. That's the lineup for today. And perhaps you will be the person to answer yes to the question,
are you a missing heir?
John B. Fontaine, born July 2nd, 1868, deceased April 20th, 1942, was really John B. Fontaine, Jr. His father was a founder of the iron foundry of Huff and Fontaine in Philadelphia. His mother was Elizabeth Cartwright, who gave her husband two children, John Jr. and Mary. Henry Fontaine, John Sr.'s brother, went to work in the iron foundry. John Jr. was shipped off to Massachusetts Institute of Technology to learn what was to be learned there about the business of making iron and steel. While his nephew was away at college, Henry worked hard in the foundry, literally from the ground up, and soon became the foreman of the shop. It was into the clanging, ringing shop that John Jr. walked one afternoon, complete with cake-eater hat and nifty Norfolk jacket, with a diploma from MIT safely in his pocket. Old John put young John in the drafting department and called upon his learning whenever he felt it was necessary. But shortly after John Jr. came home, Huff, the partner, died, and John Sr. took over all the assets of the foundry and gave his son and brother equal voices in the conduct of the business. This was fair and fine in its way, and yet at times it led to difficulties.
What's the trouble, Henry?
A question of magnesium content of that special steel we're making.
I see. Junior?
Seems to me 5% ought to be plenty.
No, more like 8 or 10, I'd say.
Makes it too brittle, Hank.
Now, look, Junior. When we made up that batch of the same stuff, well, almost the same stuff.
Henry,
Yes, John?
See that frame on the wall?
How can I help it?
Well, that represents Junior's education. Henry, I think we can afford to take his word on the magnesium content.
Well, in spite of occasional family tiffs like that, the Fontaine's life moved along smoothly enough. John Jr. never married. But in 1888, Henry married one Marceline C. Ellers. Then, as the years rolled by, seven children came to Henry Fontaine and his wife, Marcy. Sadly enough, the four eldest children died. The three survivors were all daughters. The fate of two of them is of no immediate importance to this story. That of Agnes very definitely is, because of a happening on April 20th, 1942. April 20th, 1942. Remember that. The date may be very important to you if you are Agnes Fontaine or her next of kin. Agnes' father, Henry, and her cousin, John B. Fontaine, Jr., continued in the foundry for many years. Eventually, both Henry and Marcy's wife passed on, and John, still a bachelor, sold the Huff and Fontaine Ironworks for a sizable sum. John loved good guns and spent most of his time on the range, in the woods, or cleaning, polishing, caring for his guns in the shop of a Philadelphia gunsmith named Jake Cheevis, 18 North 5th Street. In his later years, his custom was to visit the gun shop every day, watching the gunsmith at his work, swapping stories, admiring the work. That was where John Fontaine was, on the morning of April 20th, 1942.
Could use a little more number 3 oil on this one, Jake.
You'll find it on upper shelf, John.
Sure thing. Yes, I've got it. Hear that little squeak? Right in the joint here. Otherwise, she's as clean as a whistle. And nothing like an old-fashioned double-barrel 12...
John, what's wrong, you fellow?
Oh. You died the way you wanted, with a beautiful gun in your hand.
Yes, John B. Fontaine, the younger, son of the founder of Huff and Fontaine Ironworks, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, died in 1942 of a heart attack. There was and is today a residue of $13,000 in cash that belongs to John B. Fontaine's cousin, the daughter of his Uncle Henry Fontaine, by name Agnes Fontaine, or her next of kin. And thereby hangs this story. Agnes Fontaine grew to womanhood and married. Her husband was Frank Kelly. She gave Frank a son named Russell, Russell Kelly. A few years rolled by, and while Russell was still a youngster, his father died. After an interval, Agnes Fontaine Kelly married again, becoming Agnes Fontaine Pusey, P-U-S-E-Y, Pusey. But that marriage failed, and the couple were divorced. This brings us to 1923, a little more than 20 years ago, the beginning of the Roaring Twenties, when the whole nation seemed bound to over-enjoy itself. And a good deal of the roaring came from speeding motor cars on the highways leading to the famous summer resort. Places like Atlantic City, New Jersey.
Oh, say, maybe you better be careful, Joe.
Woo! Oh, wow, that was a close one.
Oh, boy, too close for comfort. Ah, curve coming up, Joe.
Yeah, and watch me take it. High gear and high speed. Speedy Joe, they call me.
Hey, Joe, look out. Joe, pull over the right. Yeah, Joe!
It was one of those very nasty crashes we used to see along the highways. The two cars, blinded by each other's headlights, met head-on. The drivers were killed. People were badly hurt. Agnes Fontaine Pusey was lucky. Minor lacerations and sent home after first aid. Sent home to disappear. She went west, it seems. In 1924, a letter came to relatives in Philadelphia. The letter was postmarked...
Toledo, Ohio.
2 years passed, another letter came, dated 1926. Postmarked
Kansas City, Missouri.
October 1926 brought another letter with 3 clues in it. The postmark,
Santa Monica, California.
The return address on the envelope,
1128 7th Street, Santa Monica, California.
And the news in the letter.
Well, I'm dropping the name of Agnes Fontaine Pusey. I'm assuming the name of Grace Lamar.
The name of Grace Lamar. In the same letter, she spelled the name another way, like first L-A-M-A-A-R, and then L-E-M-A-I-R-E, Lemaire. 1 year later, the address changed again, this time to...
General Delivery, Santa Monica, California.
And later still, Grace Lamar, or Lemaire, once again assumed her correct given name of Agnes, and her second marriage name of Pusey.
Agnes Pusey, the last name under which Agnes Fontaine Kelly Pusey, once known as Grace Lamar, was heard of. But in July 1927, Agnes Pusey drew from the personal savings account in the Security First National Bank of Los Angeles the sum of $5,000.
That was 1927, 19 years ago. No further trace of her has been discovered. And in a bank in Philadelphia is her inheritance from John B. Fontaine, Jr., $13,000 in cash. John B. Fontaine died on April 20th, 1942. If Agnes, his cousin, is still alive, she inherits the $13,000. If she was living then, but has passed on since, her son, Russell Kelly, is legal heir to the money. Remember, if you think you have a clue to Agnes Fontaine Pusey, she must have been alive after April 20th, 1942, for either one of them to be a legal heir.
Wanted. Information concerning Agnes Fontaine Kelly Pusey. once known as Grace Lamar and Grace Lemire. Age today, approximately 71. Hair gray, formerly auburn. Height, 5'2". Inclined to stoutness.
If you have this information, write or wire to the Board of Missing Heirs. Post Office Box 705, New York 7, New York. The Board of Missing Heirs offers a reward of $75 in United States savings bonds to the person first providing information leading to the discovery of Agnes Pusey, this missing heir, dead or alive. This is the story of $40,000 waiting for two people who present whereabouts, whose whereabouts are not known. The attorneys for the estate have offered a reward of $500 for information leading to the discovery and proper identification of George and Rhea Wyman or their children. Louisa Hurl spent all her life in Brooklyn and died there on October 30th, 1934. Now, Louisa had an uncle, George Wyman, who sometimes spelled his name Wayman, W-E-Y-M-A-N, or Wyman, W-Y-M-A-N. He was also known as California George, who made his living in a peculiar manner aboard ocean liners.
You play a mean game of cards, Wyman.
All in fun, Baedeker. You set the stakes, you know.
I'll admit that, but this isn't penny ante. You're into me for quite a sum.
You can have your chance from here to Southampton to get it back. After all, this is a gentleman's game.
Yeah, I've been trying to get some of it back for 2 days now. I seem to get in deeper all the time.
Well, this is my lucky trip, I guess.
Lucky, or else you're a wizard at cards.
How am I to take that, sir?
No offense, Wyman, no offense. But in all my born days, I've never seen a man with more luck and skill at the comparatively simple game of poker.
California George Wyman was skillful, and sometimes it seems his skill was abetted by that piece of gambler's equipment known colloquially as a cold deck. One evening during one of his infrequent stays in New York City, California George wandered along 14th Street, northern boundary of the district then known as the Tenderloin. The marquee of a theater attracted his attention.
Now playing, Genevieve Smith, the buxom beauty of the burlesque board. Maybe I ought to take a look at this.
California George did take a look, and he went back again and again. Finally, one evening, Genevieve Smith, known as Genevieve Smith, the burlesque star, left the theater on 14th Street to become Mrs. George Wyman. This marriage produced two children, George Jr. and Rhea. The youngsters lived with their mother at 231 East 48th Street in New York City, and it was a lonely life they lived. California George lived up to his name and traveled to the fabulous gold fields of the Golden State to continue his peculiar method of earning a living. However, his activities were cut short by a general cleanup in California. So, once again, George returned to his old haunt in New York City's Tenderloin.
Dealer, mind lifting the deck a little higher?
This better, mister?
Some. Easy does it.
Don't you like the methods of this house, mister?
Can't say I do. Not when the cards run against me as they have this evening.
You'd rather have me deal off the bottom to give you a decent hand?
Yes, rather than have you give yourself a decent hand from the bottom of a cold deck.
Take that back.
You can have it back with this as an extra present. Oh.
It was justifiable homicide at the inquest. At California George's home, it was something else again. Genevieve's patience was exhausted. She packed her belongings and little George and Rhea with them. Genevieve returned to burlesque and the children with her. Later, following her separation from California George, Genevieve gave the children into the care of Louisa Hurl's other uncle, George's brother, Frederick Wyman, who was living at 731 Gates Avenue, Brooklyn, New York. This was in the early 80s, and in 1885, Genevieve went to Europe. When she returned, she called for George and Rhea, only to discover that they had moved across the river to an unknown address in New York. Whether Genevieve Wayman ever found her son and daughter is unknown to this day. Meanwhile, California George went his way until the morning of August 20th in 1897. It was a lovely summer dawn that broke over Central Park that morning, revealing the forms of New Yorkers who had spent the stifling night sleeping on the benches and the lawns.
Hey, what's going on?
Right over here. Yeah, here he is. This fella here. Here he is, folks. Right here.
Hey, wait a minute. Wait a minute. No use getting excited, folks. The police will have to take care of this. Poor fella sure took the easy way out.
The poor fellow was California George Wineman, who died by his own hand on August 20th, 1897, according to the files of the New York Herald. Little is known of the careers or whereabouts of George Jr. or his sister Rhea. The few facts in our possession are, one,
they are known to have traveled through many western cities.
Fact two,
Rhea Wyman was a singer and dancer in vaudeville.
Fact three,
George Wyman did much traveling in some unknown capacity in the theatrical business.
But George and Rhea Wyman, son and daughter of California George and Genevieve Wyman, are the legal heirs, share and share alike, to $40,000 left by their cousin, Louise Hurl, of Brooklyn, New York. If George and Rhea have passed on also, this money goes to their children.
Have you information concerning these missing heirs? Are you one of these missing heirs? If you are, or if you have information, write or wire to the Board of Missing Heirs, Post Office Box 705, New York 7, New York. And remember, the attorneys for the estate of Louisa Hurl will pay you a reward of $500 for the correct and proper information concerning George and Rhea Wyman or their legal heirs.
Frederick L. Sage was a true man of mystery. His origins are unknown. His death was cloaked in drama. Two facts are of immediate importance.
Frederick L. Sage died on October 21st, 1945. Frederick L. Sage left an estate of $45,000 entirely in cash to be claimed by heirs unknown to this date.
Frederick L. Sage came to the thriving, booming metropolis of Chicago, Illinois in the early 1900s with his charming and talented wife, Clara. They came from the East, and Sage assumed his duties of sales representative for the firm of Hiram Swank, clay molding products of Johnstown, Pennsylvania. Frederick Sage had at least one favorite topic of conversation, scenes he had witnessed in his early days in the steel business, of which clay molds form an important part.
You mean to tell me, Sage, that you saw that trouble?
I certainly did. I was there when the Army took over. And that was before the days of big unions like the CIO. And back there in the 80s, a strike always meant trouble.
Times have sure changed. Quite a life you've had.
Yes, I saw Gary, Indiana, and South Chicago built. I saw the mud flats grow into cities with huge steel mills at their heart. I've seen plenty in my time, both good and bad. I wouldn't have missed it for the world.
Clara Sage was a woman of fine, if not professional, musical talent. Old friends of the Sages remember the evenings at their home or at clubs and societies where Clara Sage held the center of everyone's attention.
Lovely woman, Clara Sage.
With music in her fingers.
Not only her fingers. You ever hear her sing?
No. Good?
Excellent. Sometimes I think she'd have done well in opera.
I see. Perhaps that accounts for the Sage's interest in Chicago opera. They both worked very hard for it, you know.
It's a little strange, you know. Here they are, pleasant, comfortable people, very well off, and yet, when you get right down to it, what do we know about them?
Very little, I suppose. I know they came to Chicago from the East.
Everyone knows that, but where in the East? What city? What state? Have they any relatives?
Sage said something once.
Oh, you mean you cracked the mystery?
Oh, hardly that. He mumbled something once about having to get a check off in the mail to pay for some nephew's college education or something like that.
Well, family, eh?
Yeah. And you know those vacation trips they take, always back East.
Well, someday something will turn up, although you never can tell.
Oh. you never can tell, and Frederick Sage never did tell. One piece of evidence about those summer vacations did come to hand. It seems it was the sort of second honeymoon.
Well, now, is this all right, dear?
A little more to the left, Clara.
Hmm?
No, not yourself. Just turn your head.
Oh, Fred, now, for heaven's sake, why do you fuss so?
I want to get the light just right. The sun was causing a shadow on your upper lip.
Well, how is this?
Fine. Hold it. Ah, there, I got it.
You know, it is better to be a lot better than the snapshots you took at a gunfoot and ride.
Oh, this one will be, I promise you. We label it, taken at Old Orchard Beach, Maine, in the amusement park, on our second honeymoon.
The picture Sage took of his wife that summer day in Old Orchard Beach is one of the few and very meager links with his past. Links that snapped almost completely when Clara Sage died about 12 years ago. Then Frederick Sage lived by himself in the Hyde Park section of Chicago's South Side and continued on his daily round of the steel mills almost to the day of his own death. Early in the morning, his chauffeur would call for him. Their conversation was barely more than...
Good morning, sir.
Good morning, James. We'll go out to Gary this morning.
Yes, sir.
And in the evening, when they returned to the door of the South Side apartment house...
Good night, James. Early tomorrow.
Yes, sir. On the dot. Good night, sir.
That was all. No confidences between man and master. Practically no conversation. Just the necessities of greetings, directions, and farewells. Until one morning in October last year.
Oh, well, if he has gone out, gives me the day off.
The chauffeur went back to the garage and waited there all day for a call from Mr. Sage, but none came. The next morning, shortly after 8, he tried again.
That's funny. Wonder what's wrong with a cat. Huh. This will take some looking into.
Okay, son. What's the trouble?
Well, Sergeant, this is the second morning I've called for my boss, Frederick Sage, with the car, and he hasn't answered my knock.
Has he ever done that before?
Well, once or twice, yeah.
Okay, then. Why worry?
Well, it's his cat. He keeps meowing at the other side of the door.
Never you mind the cat, son. Cats and meow for just no reason at all. Or maybe just because they're alone. Try again tomorrow and let us know over at the precinct.
This is it, Sergeant.
Cat still crying?
Listen.
Cat's there, all right.
Yeah. All right, I think we better do something, Sergeant.
Like busting in the door, maybe, huh?
Yeah. I'll pay for it if nothing's wrong.
Okay, son. Lend a shoulder now.
Yeah.
You were right, son. This your Mr. Sage?
Yeah. Maybe if we'd broken down the door the first day...
Now, don't worry about that. I'm no medical examiner, but I've seen bodies before. Mr. Sage has been dead in that chair at least 3 days.
Frederick L. Sage died of a heart attack on October 21st, 1945, the date determined by the Chicago medical examiner. No one of his old friends, what few there were, can throw light on his relatives, on any of the nieces and nephews he never saw. But if you are a relative of Frederick L. Sage, or if you have any information that will bring one of these unknown missing heirs to light, write or wire to the Board of Missing Heirs, Post Office Box 705, New York 7, New York. Remember,
Frederick L. Sage died in Chicago on October 21st, 1945. A man of mystery, mysterious beginnings, inconspicuous life, lonely ending, but leaving an estate of $45,000 in cash. Are you one of his missing heirs?
This is James Marshall, counselor and advisor to the Board of Missing Heirs, with our final case. 20 years ago, Mary O'Brien, daughter of John J. O'Brien and Mary Harrington, disappeared. At that time, she was 55 years old. Mary O'Brien has been traced to...
Hackensack, New Jersey. She worked as a housekeeper.
White House, New Jersey. Cutterson, New Jersey. Plainfield, New Jersey.
Plainfield was Mary O'Brien's last address in 1922. There is no further trace of this woman, who would be 75 years old on September 8th this year if she were still living. Held in trust for her or her next of kin is the sum of $7,700. Do you know Mary O'Brien, daughter of John Jay and Mary O'Brien? Are you her next of kin? Have you information that will lead to the solution of this mystery? Can you answer yes to the question,
are you this missing heir?
The cases you have heard tonight, the clues, names, places, and dates, are the best facts available to the administrators of the unclaimed estates in question. Unclaimed estates to the total value of $105,700. If you are one of the missing heirs to one of these unclaimed estates, communicate with us at once. Write or wire the Board of Missing Heirs, Post Office Box 705, New York 7, New York. If you have information that would lead to the positive identification of a missing heir, communicate with us at once. In case of duplicate information, the writer of the letter bearing the earliest postmark or the sender of the telegram bearing the earliest time will receive the $75 savings bond reward. And above all, remember this. Next week, more information, more clues concerning other missing heirs. Next week, the Board of Missing Heirs may broadcast the information that will lead you to answer yes to the question,
are you a missing heir?
Heard the Board of Missing Heirs, presented by the American Broadcasting Company. Today, you heard the clues to the missing heirs of unclaimed estates to the value of $105,700. Next week, on most of these ABC stations, you will hear more facts, more figures, more interesting cases on the Board of Missing Heirs. Board of Missing Heirs is produced by James F. Waters and Alfred E. Chabelle. Adapted for radio by Ira Marion and directed by Charles Harrell. Individuals portrayed on this program were impersonated. G.I. Money was what the Chislers were after. And they worked out a tricky scheme which they thought was foolproof. Be sure to hear this amazing story which follows next on David Harding, Counter Spy. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.